From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Get ready to take notes. We're going to spend a few minutes today with linguist Steven Pinker on making writing sharper.
Is that the sharpest way you could have said that?
Yes.
Yes, definitely. But first, let's get to Dallas and the response to the first confirmed case of Ebola in the U.S. Multiple media reports identify the patient as a Liberian man named Thomas Eric Duncan. 80 people are now being monitored for Ebola symptoms, including children, according to Dallas County Health and Human Services. Only 12 to 18 people, though, actually had contact with the man who is sick. The rest are secondary contact. So far, no one is showing symptoms. Even so, some parents in Dallas are keeping their kids home from school out of fear about Ebola. Dr. Joseph McCormick is an infectious disease specialist at the University of Texas School of Public Health. He was also involved in investigating the first recorded outbreak of Ebola back in 1976. He's with us from Brownsville, Texas. Dr. McCormick, welcome.
Thank you.
So the prevailing narrative here from the CDC and the White House is that there is not going to be an outbreak of Ebola in the United States the way we've seen in Africa, and that we have the capacity to deal with this and stop it in its tracks. Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, we have some evidence for this, actually. In the very first outbreak of a related virus called Marburg virus, that occurred in 1967 in Marburg, Germany, as you might gather from the name, we saw 31 cases of Marburg, and these were all people who handled monkey tissues from monkeys brought from Uganda. And this was the first time we ever saw the appearance of this family of viruses. And interestingly, we had 31 cases, 7 deaths, and only one secondary transmission. And this was in the face of something nobody had ever seen. Yet later in 1998 and again in 2005, there were big outbreaks of Marburg disease in the Congo and then in 2005 in Angola. All of these resulted in tremendous numbers of secondary cases. And this is because these occurred in poor communities with no medical infrastructure, poor education, and really no method of addressing this in this kind of situation. So I would argue that's an example of what we're seeing today, where the problems in West Africa are very substantial, and they are more related to the lack of resources, poor education, poor medical facilities, than just the disease itself. We know how to contain the disease. And so therefore, I don't think we're going to see this kind of a problem at all in the U.S.
Still, if you start to play out the scenario in the U.S. And you look at the numbers, and we know now that the number of potential Ebola contacts in Dallas has grown to 80 because the 12 to 18 people initially exposed had secondary contacts. And then you start to think about, well, who did those people see
Wait a minute. If you are well, You may have secondary contacts, but if those contacts happened when you were perfectly well and you're not ill, you're not transmitting anything. So you can eliminate those contacts. And I think this is what's going to happen over the next day or so, is they're going to start to sort out who actually was a direct contact of the guy who's sick, because those are the ones at risk. And the others, if they are contacts of contacts and those contacts were perfectly well, which they are, they're not at risk.
How do public health officials determine how much effort and energy to put into something like this? Because if you think about it, we've got an average of, 23,000 deaths from the flu every year. And in this case, we have in the United States one known case of Ebola, no fatalities so far.
Right. And what is going on right now is exactly what should go on. Identify all potential contacts, and then get the details about the nature of their contacts, and then you can make a decision about what level of surveillance you need to put them in. And what we want to avoid is panic, but we also want to avoid complacency, and that's a fine line. We have to balance that, and that's what I'm sure they're doing in Dallas in trying to determine who is really at risk, and let's focus our attention on those people. The other people who are far lower risk, we will give some attention to, but not the same as those who were in direct physical contact with this fellow when he was ill.
What would you say to parents in Dallas who might be keeping their kids home from school today? Is that the wrong thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. The children that their children were in contact with are now under surveillance. They were not ill when they were at the school. So they're not at risk of transmitting the virus.
But if you do find somebody who's been in contact with an Ebola patient, you don't quarantine them right away?
If they've been in physical contact with an ill Ebola patient, absolutely.
But if they were in contact with him before, let's say one of these 12 to 18 people, then no, you allow them to go about their lives.
Well, you put them under surveillance, and you would use your public health workers to check them twice a day for any sign of fever, because that's the earliest sign. And at that sign, you know, they're starting to replicate virus, but they're not yet in a situation where they're going to be transmitting to people. And that's the point then which you would put them in isolation and start treating them. And had they done that on the Friday when this guy came in, we'd be in a lot better shape than we are now.
Dr. Joseph McCormick, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Texas School of Public Health. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.